danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 190 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Catonsville, Maryland. I'm Andrew Brokus, joined in, I imagine, Cambridge, Massachusetts by Nate Mavis. And in Atlanta, Georgia, or thereabouts, Carlos Welch. Hi, guys.
How you doing, man?
I'm good. It's good to talk to you. I was thinking, I'm not sure if we've really spoken much since WSOP.
I don't think so, no. Not in, not audio, I guess. We've had
Our DMs and
Twitter and, yeah.
And Nate, you are in Cambridge, is that accurate?
I am in Cambridge. I'm in Cambridge, hanging out, doing work, following Carlos as he crushes tournament after tournament at the Wynn.
Yeah, that's a fun little run I'm on there.
Yeah, so is that, I mean, it seemed like for a while you were kind of disillusioned with live poker and you were really loving the online stuff.
Yeah, that was primarily during the summer where the fields are like 10 times as big, but I found this little sweet spot at the Wynn where the tournaments are like 100 people max, and those are a lot easier to final table. It reminds me of my Binion's days from like 2013.
That's nice. I think people really underestimate the importance of making final tables consistently. I mean, both from like a bankroll management point of view, like you need a way smaller bankroll to play a 100 field tournament than a 1,000 field tournament of the same buy-in size. But just from a sort of like confidence and, I guess, as you would say, happiness EV point of view, I mean, it's like you're not going to have a lot of 100 buy-in downswings.
Yeah, exactly. What I like to say is I don't enjoy tournament poker for the sake of playing tournament hands. I want to make final tables. So like if somebody just like gave me a free roll into the Colossus every day for the rest of my life, I wouldn't take it. Wow. That doesn't sound like fun at all to me.
I will say, as from the perspective of someone investing in you in these tournaments, it's a little anticlimactic to be like, oh, Carlos made the final table. Carlos got fifth place. We doubled our money.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough to do much worse than that, though, in these. That's almost like the floor. And fifth to double your money is probably like one payout from fourth to get like an even chop with like two bigs, which would be like 10 times your money or whatever. So against the people I'm playing with, there's also chop equity. If you can, you can actually make a profit in chopping deals if you get to that point in the tournament against these guys.
And who's playing these things? I mean, are there other regulars, or is it just like you and a bunch of tourists?
There's a few other regulars. The majority of the regulars are not that great either, which is a good thing. I'll say that I don't think I've ever seen anybody I recognize in any of the fields. In terms of people I know from online, people that I know from playing at circuit events, it's just like, I guess the regulars are all Vegas locals who don't travel much, and you get a few tourists as well.
So what brought you back to Atlanta?
There was a concert here in Atlanta this weekend. There's a festival called A3C, which is basically like all the underground rappers from all over the world just descend on Atlanta for like 5 days and just nonstop shows. And I used to attend that every year, but last year I didn't go because it was a little bit, it's starting to get more commercialized and more expensive. Mm-hmm. It's like they're trying to turn it into South by Southwest, but it used to be more of a, I don't know, it was just better, like, you know, 3-4 years ago. So I didn't go last year, but this year, one of my favorite artists and a friend, 3D Nati, was performing And so I decided, you know, this will be a good time because I didn't play at the Wynn this weekend because they had the Wynn Classic Main Event, which is a $1,600 buy-in, which will attract all the real pros in Vegas, and I don't want to play against those guys. So I was like, you know, I got a weekend off. Let's go home, go to the concert, see family, pick up mail from my P.O. box. Yeah, so I got like four or five. This is another thing. I started to write a tweet about this earlier, but I didn't get around to it. Like, I go to my P.O. box, and I have like three checks saved up in the mail from like articles I've written. And it's like, man, I can remember when I was working and buying my house. I was basically living paycheck to paycheck. But now that I'm living in a van, I could basically just let stacks pile up, checks pile up in a P.O. box and just get them whenever.
So watch the money pile up.
Yeah. It's nice.
And then I guess you're not, you said you're flying back, so you're just like staying with your mom or something when you're in Atlanta?
Yeah, so I was just here for the weekend. So I came in on Friday, which is apparently the worst possible time to try to fly into Atlanta with Hurricane Matthew. So my flight got delayed for like 2.5 hours, but I finally got here and I'm flying out today in about 5 hours.
Yeah, thanks for making time for us this morning.
Oh, no problem.
So I think two of the three of us are living at our mom's houses right now. I mean, in the loose sense of living.
Right.
Congratulations, so, Nate, on being an independent man.
I do my best. Yeah, I'm living the anti-Carlos life these days, full of responsibilities. A dog I walk 5 times a day and things like that. So
5 times a day.
Yeah, sounds extreme.
Yeah. Well, he needs to go out. We're training him. He's a rescue, and we really like walking the dog. So yeah, we're on a schedule for that. But it's good. It adds structure. It's
and like Carlos, he's a Southerner.
Exactly. Yep. He's from Alabama, and total sweetheart.
Awesome.
But no, I'm not living in a van, nor.
Don't worry, you'll get there one day. Keep striving.
I think Nate is the least likely of the three of us to end up living in a van.
I think so too.
I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah, that seems likely.
And the van living is still working out nicely for you in Vegas?
Well, actually, like you said, we haven't talked in a while, so you guys haven't gotten...
I actually think I do know the answer to this, because I heard your interview on TPE, but go on.
Okay, so I'll tell it for the Think and Poker audience. So my original plan was to drive my van out to Vegas this summer and then just stay out there and live in the van. And so the whole van deal that I've been doing, like, I guess last July is when I bought the van. And I also got an office space for like $200 a month. So I would work and play poker in the office during the day, and then I would just sleep in the van at night. So so a lot of people were worried about me, like, you know, living in a van in Vegas. And I had to explain to people that, yeah it's going to be hot during the day, but I'm usually not in the van during the day. You know, I have the office for that. So I went to Vegas this summer. I got an office space during the summer. I didn't use it much because I had tons of friends. The TPE guys had a house, and then Mike Snyderman had a room at the Rio. So I just crashed with these guys for the majority of the time. So I paid for this office and rarely even used it. But the times I did use it, I didn't really like it. Like, I tried to do a stream from the office, and the internet connection there wasn't great. And also there was like some, I guess, a music teacher or something in the office next to me. So like, I'd be trying to stream and there would be somebody playing the piano and like singing in Spanish. So that was weird. So I decided to go to the Cherokee Circuit event, which is in North Carolina, right after the summer. So I drove back across the country for that. And then afterwards, I drove back to Vegas, and this time I was like, okay, when I get a new office, because I only had a 3-month lease for the summer, I'm going to get an office in a different spot. and I went office shopping, and I found one that I wanted for $300 a month. So it was a little bit more expensive than what I was used to paying, but it was fine. It seemed like it would be a better situation for me. But it turns out that they were advertising the office, but they couldn't actually lease it to me because they, at least not at the time they said they could, because the person who was in the office before I was going to get it was just going to move into a bigger office in the same office building. And by the time I showed up, they hadn't moved their stuff out yet. So the office manager guy was like, he's not comfortable taking my money and renting me this office until this other person is officially out. But this was on like a Saturday, and I'm thinking, okay, well, tomorrow's Sunday. My plan was to get in here so I can do my grind, my Sunday grind. So now I got to find somewhere to grind on Sunday. So I started looking for hotel rooms, and somehow, I don't know how, I never knew about this, but I found this place about an hour and a half south of Vegas called Laughlin, and they have like hotel rooms for like $20 a month. $20 a night during the week. And so I had like a package deal that first week where I stayed from Sunday through Thursday for a total of $92, including taxes, no resort fees, anything like that. So I went down there, and then I got the idea, like, man, instead of spending $300 a month on an office space, I can just spend like $100 a week, you know, on a hotel room down here. And that's what I've been doing, is just staying in the hotel room Sunday through Thursday, and then on Friday and Saturday, driving back up to Vegas to play at the Wynn, and then just sleeping in my van on the weekend. So I was telling Killenberg this, and he was like, oh, so now you're the semi-homeless poker player. So I was like, okay, yeah, I guess that is a more accurate name. So
Yeah, I saw that on your Skype description.
Yeah, so that's what I'm doing now. I'm homeless. I'm sleeping in the van 2 days a week, and 5 days a week I'm living in a hotel.
Not too shabby.
I'm absolutely loving it.
And I know you're not the most social person in the world, but I mean, do you have friends in Vegas who you see? I know, obviously, you'll know like poker players who come through town at certain times, but
no, I don't have any people who live in Vegas that I talk to on a regular basis. I do have a lot of, like you said, poker friends who live in Vegas, but we don't see each other much at this point. I have run into like podcast listeners that I've hung out with in Vegas. One in particular, David, was in town one weekend where I played at the Wynn. And so he bought a piece, him and his buddy, were in town. I guess they were just playing cash games, but it was cool for me to have those guys railing me while I play the Wynn tournament that they have a piece of. And I just met them. They're really cool guys. We got along really great. Plus, I was able to win them a huge chunk of money. This is one of the times where I didn't get fifth. So that weekend, I think I got third for like $1,000. Maybe, no, 2,000. I can't remember. I think it was 2,000 on Friday. And then on Saturday, I chopped it for first for 5,000.
Yeah, that was a nice weekend.
Yeah. So David, that was like his first time investing. So right off the bat, I'm thinking like, man, he's going to be disappointed when I don't chop it next weekend. but you know, it was cool to hang out with him. And I imagine I'll run into a lot of other new friends that I'll meet along the way. But no, I don't currently have anybody that I talk to on a regular basis in Vegas.
But you're good with that? I mean, you're not getting lonely out there?
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad you brought that word up. So glad. So I did a Twitch stream, right? And one of the viewers on my stream, I was talking about, you know, being happily single and, like, you know, not in a relationship. And somebody was telling me about a TED Talk. There was like a 75-year study on happiness, and said that the conclusion was single people die earlier. And so I'm like, okay, let me go watch this. And when I watched it, I was like, okay, this guy misunderstood the point, the conclusion. The conclusion was lonely people die earlier. And I was like, being alone is not the same thing as being lonely if you like yourself. So yeah, I'm constantly alone for the most part, but I enjoy my own company, so I'm definitely not lonely, you know. So
I would think there's one factor that contributes to the mortality of especially single men is not having someone encouraging them to go to the doctor.
Yeah, I mean,
but I know you did your lab work recently.
Right. So I think that could be a problem for some people, but I don't know if that was the gist of the study. I think the study was like not having those emotional connections to other humans when you're like going through problems. So that I can understand, like if I ever went through a hard time, I would probably, you know, seek, you know, human interaction.
But well, when and you do have those people if you need them, right? I mean, you know, like you have a relationship with your mom, you're just not like seeing her all the time.
Right. I don't think I have to like find some chick to marry to you know, you know, just, you know, in case I ever hit a rocky time in my life. You know, I definitely have, you know, humans I can talk to.
So when you're at the doctor and they ask you basic lifestyle questions, how long does it take them to figure out that you live in a van, et cetera? And are they surprised to hear this? Like, what does your doctor say about your lifestyle?
They don't know. I'm like, that's not even something I ever get into it with. Okay. Get into it now. I don't even know how they. I mean, now you got me curious. Like, okay, could they like ask particular questions that would have them figure that out? Like, they ask, you know, a list of 5 or 6 questions. Do you live in a van by chance?
No, but I mean, so my nurse always, like, when I'm getting a physical, she always asks me, like, what kind of exercise I'm getting and under what circumstances I'm getting exercise and, like, whether my living situation is, like, stressful or not, et cetera. And I think if I lived in a van, she would very quickly learn that I lived in a van.
Well, I guess most of my... So what Andrew was talking about is I did a bunch of lab work at Theranos, which is a kind of, I guess it's hard to describe, like a walk-in. Like you can do like walk-in blood tests. So oh, I just Theranos? Walked.
The, yeah. Oh man. The
so,
the,
so you're familiar with Theranos. I figured you would be, you know.
Yeah. No,
because that you're into like tech.
Yeah, I'm in biotech. I'm also.
But yeah, so I went to Theranos and basically got a bunch of the lab tests done for pretty cheap, and I didn't have to like talk to a doctor to do that. Okay. So I guess so that's the difference. I don't, you know, have these conversations with doctors. I just walk in and get the tests I ordered.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't have a regular doctor because I've moved around so much, but the last time I went for a physical, you know, the doctor was just sort of asking me, just getting to know me, I guess, as though he were going to become my regular doctor. And I told him that I played poker, and he goes, oh, I went to high school with someone who became a professional poker player. And he was like, you know, maybe late 50s or 60s. I was like, oh, there's a decent chance I would know who that is. And he goes, yeah, his sister was a poker player too. I was like, come on. So I kind of let him go on for a minute. It was Letter and Annie Duke. And I let him go on for like a minute or two about how kind of like brilliant they were. And I was like, you know, they kind of don't have the best reputation in the poker world these days. He's like, oh yeah, I think I heard something about that.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny.
If you are not already a member of Tournament Poker Edge, now is a great time to sign up. I am just starting to put up, or actually by the time you hear this, probably most of them will be up, my videos reviewing my play in the 2016 World Series of Poker main event. I did not go particularly deep, but I did play a bunch of interesting hands. I think a lot of them well, maybe a few of them not well, but I think certainly a lot of stuff that will surprise you and be pretty different from what you're used to doing. I think a lot of you will find that real interesting. And you can also on there find some review from Nate Mavis's 2015 main event. We've got a review of a tournament that Carlos played, Carlos and I, reviewing one of Carlos's big victories. So lots of good stuff from us and plenty of other professional poker players available to you on tournamentpokeredge.com. Our strategy question today is coming to us from Justin. Justin said, I thought this hand was slightly interesting because it deals with being donked into and how to deal with this, as it is not the most common thing to see. I myself find that I have trouble in these situations many a time. And just cutting in with my own editorializing here, I think this is a pretty common thing that people... I feel like we get a lot of questions about donk bets. I know we've discussed other ones on the show before, but it seems like a thing that a lot of people sort of... have trouble dealing with, or just, you know, because it doesn't happen that often, that they're sort of unsure how to proceed. How do you guys feel about that? I mean, Carlos, do you is this something that you encounter as a difficulty facing dunk bets?
I do face them sometimes. They're not like a particular difficulty, like any in terms of like, they don't stand out as, like, one of the most difficult things I face on a daily basis when I play. So I just deal with them as they come. So I really don't have a good answer to how to deal with them. It's just, like, everything is based on table dynamics at the time for me with those.
I mean, I think deal with them as they come is actually very good advice, because I think part of what sort of freaks people out about it is they feel like they have to do something really exploitive. You know, they're like, oh, you know, he made a dunk bet, so, am I supposed to be attacking this really often because it's weak, or, you know, is it really strong and I'm supposed to be folding a lot? And it's like, it doesn't have to be anything. You know, I mean, sometimes you're in a position to guess what it means, and if you are, great, and, you know, you go from there. But just in a vacuum, the fact that, you know, somebody bet into you, even though you were the pre-flop raiser, doesn't really have to mean anything in particular. And you can still kind of assess the situation and say, you know, what, how much does this flop favor me versus them?
Right.
How much am I going to be interested in, you know, taking the pot down now potentially versus, you know, seeing more cards? Do I have a hand that, you know, that has an interest in seeing future cards, or is going to be hurt by seeing future cards? How likely is it that this person, you know, flopped a strong hand versus didn't? How much incentive would they have to bet with weaker hands? I mean, you can just, I think it's good practice to try to figure these things out on the fly. I think a donk bet isn't really like a special category of thing that you know, needs to be treated wildly differently from any other sort of poker situation. I think it's better if you're in the habit of, you know, actively trying to figure out poker situations rather than just trying to learn a set of, you know, here's how I respond to this and here's how I respond to that, which I think is sort of what's happening. People are like, they're very comfortable playing in situations where they get to do the continuation betting because that's what they're used to doing, and it's not even necessarily the most profitable way of playing the hand. It's just a thing that's comfortable for people, and facing a dunk bet is maybe outside of people's comfort zones.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Anything you want to add to that, Nate?
When somebody donk bets into me, I think they have a weak top pair, so I always raise. No, just kidding. I think you should take them as they come, but also be aware that they may have a weak laid hand that you can bluff them off of.
Yeah, it's amazing, though, that like 3 or 4 years ago, some of the study materials I was consuming, you'd be surprised at how often I heard that advice. It's probably a weak top pair, raise.
No, I was trying to make a joke. I do.
Right.
I think, you know, certainly you should take it as they come. I think the demographics are relevant if you're in the middle of Indiana or something, and you know, somebody who's 57 years old does this to you on a Jack 4 deuce board. Jack 10 is not a bad read to make. You know, if you play as though he has Jack 10, you won't be going too far wrong, I don't think. But yeah, much better to think about everything you know, situation by situation, and understand that there is some progress in poker, and it's not 2013 anymore, and you should behave accordingly and realize that some people are aware of what other people are thinking.
Okay, so let's look at an example of how to do this. So here's a hand from Justin. Said, this hand was played at a New Jersey card room. The main villain in the hand is a young kid in his early 20s, just sat down under the gun plus one and waited until his big blind instead of posting. He sat down with a full stack, but does not seem to be a regular, as he did not have a player's card and was a little confused when asked for it. He didn't seem to be too comfortable at a card table. That told me that most likely he was a recreational player and bought in for 300 because that's what everyone says to do, and maybe he's done some studying or reading, but he doesn't really know why he's buying in full. The other villain in the hand is irrelevant. He was on the button with a $230 stack and reading the newspaper. He's your typical OMC. I'm actually not sure what that stands for. I was thinking maybe the OM is old man.
Yeah, that seems right, but I'm stuck on the C.
Anyway, he's your typical OMC, if maybe that's a meaningful term to some of you. Your typical OMC, reading the newspaper, playing fit or fold. On to the hand. Hero, who covers everybody, opens to $12 under the gun with ace-king of clubs. I'm guessing this is a 1-3 game. He doesn't say explicitly, but based on the stack sizes and the raise size and whatnot, I guess this is a 1-3 game. So Hero opens to $12 under the gun with ace-king of clubs, folds to the typical OMC on the button, who calls, and the big blind with his $300 stack calls. We go three people to the flop. $33 in the pot after the rake is taken, and the flop is 8 of clubs, 7 of clubs, and an offsuit 5. So our hero has ace-king of clubs on an 8-7-5 with 2 clubs board in a 3-way pot. And the big blind now bets out $20 into the $33 pot. So if we're going to take this as it comes, what do you guys make of the dunk bet?
Can I say I think that there's a pretty good chance this is a weak made hand and we can raise. So I think if he's tight pre-flop, then you know, a hand like nines or tens is pretty likely. Even jacks or queens you'll see played like this. Certainly some better hands are possible. Like straights are an obvious candidate, but also a lot of those get folded before the flop. So I think that a hand like ace-8 suited, if he plays that, or nines through queens, is pretty likely. Another question is how to play against those hands. A raise might not be the most credible. There should be a fair number of scare cards that will come on the turn. Of course, some of those scare cards actually hit us, so I'm not sure how good that is. Another factor is that sometimes, even if our raise doesn't have a lot of credibility now, he will react to that by calling and then folding later, which is very good for us. So I think I would... Yeah, I think I would start with a raise. Plan to see how he reacts when I do that, and to likely keep betting even if I get called. Not sure he's going to go to the felt with jacks. Even if I do wind up having to put a lot of money in on the flop, like even if he decides to go with it with tens, jacks, queens, a hand like that, or even a straight in the worst case, I've got somewhere between some and a lot of equity, and when we fold, it's a good situation. So, I guess the other thing is that when we just call the flop and then raise later, I'm not sure how likely that's going to be to represent a good hand. I think in his mind, we would probably raise immediately with some of our best hands. So that should make a raise now more credible and a raise later a little bit less credible. So, yeah, I would try to win the pot. And I think that raising is a good way to win the pot.
Would you raise? Make sense? Would you raise if you had, like, kings?
Yeah, I think so. Huh, maybe that's inconsistent, Ben.
I mean, there's a case for it. Like, especially if you think he also has draws in his betting range, like you have more interest in raising kings on the flop.
Yeah, that's good.
And just like your ability to get value from ace-8 goes way down there's a ton of turns where ace-8 is going to stop putting money in the pot, which is bad for you when you have kings.
Yeah.
Right, that's my initial thought is Yeah, I mean, you know, despite us joking about it earlier, you know, just like a single eight is a pretty big part of his range. So if I have a real hand, I want to get value from it now because there's going to be a ton of scare cards. And then in this case where I don't have a real hand, I want to start repping a real hand now so that I can get them off of it when the scare cards do come.
Yeah, and you know, when we say they just kind of figured out on the fly, you know, this is an important part of figuring it out. Is kind of so obviously we have it, what we have right now. Maybe it's not obvious. I mean, there's some chance we actually have the best hand right now. I don't think we're a favorite against his betting range, but I mean, especially if we think he's betting some draws, you know, we are actually a pretty big favorite against some of the draws he could have, and we're not really very far behind, like a 9-8 kind of hand. So, you know, we do have a decent amount of value in this hand. It's not, I mean, I think it's a hand where we still would prefer fold, so I guess we can think of it as a bluff. But when we're thinking about, you know, how often should you be bluff raising a donk bet? And again, like, if you have some read that, okay, a donk bet from my opponent means he has a weak top pair and this player won't stack off with weak top pair, okay, then you should be bluff raising a lot for exploitive reasons. But if you're not really sure what the donk bet means, I think, you know, a good place to start is to think about, how wide would I be raising for value here? You know, am I going to raise sets for value, and do I have sets in my range? Which, you know, opening under the gun, probably we have all the pairs in our range. Maybe not the fives, but like the eights and the sevens, I would think are in the hero's range. So we can have the sets. We can probably have top two pair. We probably can't have straights. So, you know, if our only value range on the flop is like sets and two pair, we're not going to have those real often, and that's not going to support a particularly wide bluffing range. Now, if we can also say that we're going to raise over pairs, or at least some over pairs on the flop, now that starts to, you know, those combos start to add up a little bit more, and we get to have a little bit more of a bluffing range. And, you know, ace king of clubs might well be one of the best possible bluffing hands, such that even if we're not going to do a lot of bluff raising on this flop, this might still be a pretty good hand to do it with. But that's kind of what I have in mind when I say figure it out on the fly, is you can ask yourself a question like, how robust is my value range going to be? And then that gives you an idea of, you know, roughly how much bluffing you get to do in this situation.
What I really like about this particular board is if you can put your opponent on like a weak top pair as a significant portion of their range on an 8-high board, I like putting a lot of pressure on them because there's tons of overcards that can come. Of course, two of them actually improve our hand, but you can also hit a queen, jack, or a 10 or a 9 that can, you know, scare a guy that has a weak 8. Whereas if the board was like jack high or queen high, I think I would be less likely to raise now for the fact that there's fewer overcards they can come to scare them. And I have fewer, like you said, fewer value hands. So, like, if the board is queen high, I'm not raising jacks for value like I may do on this particular board.
I mean, this maybe gets into like how good at hand reading the big blind is, but I would argue a queen is really a scarier card if you call than if you raise. You know, like, are you raising the flop with queen jack of diamonds or something? I mean, like, I don't think you're really going to hit the queen that often if you raise the flop. I mean, you might be repping a better hand anyway, you know, like where you didn't need the queen to improve. But I don't know that the queen is actually that significant of a card after you raise the flop. Where, like, if he has ace eight, like, suddenly he's going to fold because the turn was a queen if he wasn't going to otherwise fold.
But I guess it's another hand that the guy... Like, I think generally players who, like you said, aren't sophisticated.
Right, that's the key question. Is he just going to look at it as like, oh no, an overcard to my pair?
Exactly, right. Exactly. Like, you know, queen comes, jack comes, and by the river he has, in his mind, I have third pair. Third pair is not worth stacking off with here.
Right.
With no, you know, concept of how you got to that point.
Another question that's worth asking in terms of whether this is a good bluffing hand is whether we think the opponent is most likely to respond when he doesn't fold, whether he's going to respond most often by calling or by three betting. And this is a good point that that our correspondent makes, he says, I thought about raising here, but didn't want to get 3-bet. And I think that's a really important thing to consider. So first you have to consider, you know, how are you going to feel about getting 3-bet? Is it going to be a problem for you? And then you also have to consider how likely is it? Because even if we think that getting 3-bet here would be a problem for us, if the villain is very rarely going to 3-bet, then we might just be, you know, 5% of the time he 3-bets and it sucks, but 95% of the time he either calls or folds, and we have a pretty good hand for those scenarios. But if we do think that, you know, there's a significant chance of a 3-bet, and I think that on this board, especially against a more aggressive player, which this player may not be, but, you know, people who will 3-bet a bit wider on a flop like this one, where, you know, they might have some draws in their range, and then they're also going to, you know, 3-bet their 2-pair plus for value, and maybe even 3-bet some combo hands, that can be a somewhat tougher range to play against. So that's an important thing to consider when you think about raising a hand like pocket queens or ace king of clubs on this flop, is like, is it going to be a problem for you if you get 3-bet? And that would actually be an important consideration for me in terms of whether or not I would raise queens on the flop. Is like, I mean, if you get 3-bet by a balanced range when you hold queens, what's happened is just the value of your queens has been killed. You know, a balanced 3-betting range here is going to be making queens basically indifferent to continuing, which means that the value of your queens has gone to zero. Right, calling with them is really no better than folding them. So, you know, queens is certainly a hand where getting 3-bet sucks. With ace-king of clubs, it may not. It's probably the case either that you're rarely going to face a 3-bet or that you don't mind facing a 3-bet. So if your opponent 3-bets more aggressively, then your equity against his 3-betting range goes way up to the point where you don't have to feel too bad about continuing to it. He might have a 3-bet folding range, which is great when you shove the flop. He might 3-bet and get it in with a few hands that you actually have in, you know, that you have pretty good equity against, like a 10-9 of clubs or something. And you know, if he is 3-betting somewhat wider, like 7-6 or something, you know, your equity is fine against a hand like that. So he can't really have that many nutted hands. Like, it's hard to make sets. It's hard to make straights. He's not going to have those hands that often, which means you're either not going to get 3-bet very much, or he's going to 3-bet with a wider range, and your equity won't be so bad against it. But I think that is a really important thing to think about, is how am I going to feel if I get 3-bet? I guess the other thing, this is a little bit more exploitive, but I tend to err on the side of calling rather than raising donk bets, especially if stacks aren't that deep, which here they're not, because oftentimes people will give away a lot of information on the turn if you give them the chance. So, you know, right now we don't really know what this $20 bet means. And the more confident you are what it means, then, you know, the more you should be able to just find a good exploitive response to it. But if you don't really know, like, what kind of hand he has based on this bet, there's a fair chance that it'll tell you on the turn, right? If he likes the turn card, he'll bet again, and then you can decide accordingly. And maybe his bet size will even tell you something. And, you know, if it seems like a scary, you know, situation, he might check and you can start putting pressure on him. So, I mean, this is the sort of board that tends to favor the player who's in position, because the turn card is very likely to be significant. It's very likely that by the time we get to the river, hands that were strong on the flop will not be very strong anymore, and that sort of dynamic favors the player who has position. So giving yourself room, not necessarily with this hand, but with your range in general, giving yourself room to play the hand out over multiple streets with money behind when you have position, that's probably going to favor you, and even more so if your opponent is going to do exploitable bet sizing kind of things on future streets. You know, if you know your opponent is exploitable, but this particular thing, you don't really know what it means, you might want to give him a chance to give you some information later in the hand. The one other important factor here we didn't mention, there is a third player in this hand. You know, we sort of know because he told us that he doesn't end up becoming a factor, but, you know, the presence of a third player in the pot does make raising a hand like queens more appealing to prevent that player from, you know, overcalling with the hand that has equity, and which also means, you know, that if you're raising more for value, again, you can do more bluff raising. So bottom line, I mean, this feels pretty close to me with ace-king of clubs, and I wouldn't be surprised if, I mean, you can't really do an equilibrium thing for a three-handed pot, but, I mean, generally, what we find is that with hands like nut flush draws, you want to have a mix of calling and raising with them. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, barring any kind of exploitive read on this player, if it didn't really make much difference whether we raised or called this hand. I think they both have, they're both pretty viable lines in the absence of some sort of exploitive read on the player who's dunking. Our correspondent goes on to say, I thought about raising here, but didn't want to get 3-bet. I felt that there are a lot of turn cards that are advantageous to me. In addition to any ace, king, or club, I can bluff any queen and sometimes a jack. This also allows me to reevaluate the turn, and on the off chance the button has a club draw as well, he would be calling the original bet but not raising. I did not think the big blind was playing 4-6 or 9-6, so I didn't think he had any straights in his range. His most likely holdings were sets, 7-8 suited, 6s, 9s, 10s, or sometimes jacks. One could argue that we are doing well against this range, however, I do not have poker stuff. So I think if his if you really think his range is that strong, I think there's a pretty good case for just calling. You know, a lot of our arguments for raising were based on the possibility that this player might have somewhat weaker than that, you know, like 9-8, 10-8, king-8, ace-8. If you don't think he's going to have those hands, I think there's less of a case for raising. But I don't know that we really have reason to take those hands out of his range. I think a lot of players will play a hand like that in this way.
Yeah, I think he's more likely to play those hands this way than a set. Like, generally, I think people, like they love to put you on ace-king. And if he has a set, why not check and get a c-bet out of a hand like ace-king?
I guess because he's afraid of all the draws on the board would be the counter-argument.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of times, I think you'll see, like, on boards like this, I think you'll see people bet, especially, like, two pair, because they're pretty sure it's the best hand, but they also know it's really vulnerable, and they want to, like, put a lot of money in now or just win the pot now, especially if he had bet a little larger than, like, if he had potted it, I would say, you know, two pair starts to feel pretty likely to me.
Yeah, yeah, I can see him having two pair, even with the dunk bet, especially, like, bottom two, but sets, I think we can discount somewhat, because they're less vulnerable.
Okay. Nate, anything you want to add to that?
I like it. And again, thinking from the point of view of you know, constructing ranges, and we're not exactly sure what he has, ace, king of clubs, as opposed to other combinations of cards that include a king, is a good thing to have in our range. I would not fold this flop 100% with ace, king, no club to a donk bet. So I will hit this king sometimes.
We're not on the turn yet. I just meant.
Fucking A.
Any thoughts on what I or Carlos or Justin have said so far?
Man, you caught me cheating. I was starting to think already. No, I have no thoughts at all.
Okay, we'll let you go first on the turn then. So our hero does just call the bet. The button folds. We go to the turn, which is the king of hearts. So our board now is 8 of clubs, 7 of clubs. Offsuit 5, king of hearts, and our hero holding ace, king of clubs with $70 in the pot. The big blind bets $35, half of the pot. Nate, go on.
Yeah, so I think villain's going to have either a little bit or a lot here. So, you know, this looks a lot like, you know, this still looks a lot like tens, but it could also be, you know, a set or a straight. I think it's fairly likely he's weak, but probably can't continue to erase. I think that, you know, goofballs like me will get to this turn with a king sometimes, even when we don't have ace, king of clubs. And when we do have the nut flush draw, is generally, other things equal, a nice time to choose calling instead of raising if it's close. I think we can get as much value by calling as we can by raising now, and our hand is not very vulnerable at all when we're ahead. And I'm very sorry for getting lost in the email and starting to think about the turn while you guys were still talking about stuff. I apologize.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those cases where it's obviously a really good card for us, but it's not necessarily a card where we want to play a huge pot. I don't know that a lot of worse hands are calling raises, and as you said, we don't really have to worry about. I mean, there are some bad river cards, but you know, the 9 of clubs, for instance, is not such a problem for us. So unlike if we had ace, king of spades for some reason, we don't have to worry very much about protecting this hand. There's not too many river cards that are going to be disasters for us. Anything you want to add to that, Carlos?
I had a couple of questions. I missed the bet size on the turn.
35 into 70.
Okay. And also, do we know if the king of hearts, like, was the 5 on the flop, was that also a heart?
I'm guessing no. He didn't give us the suit, so I don't know
that. Gotcha. Yeah. I think I like a call here for the reason stated. And if he's bluffing, you know, we got pretty good bluff catcher now, so just keep calling. And if he's value betting worse, I don't want to raise and scare him away. Like, this is a card I would raise if I happen to have, like, the ace queen of clubs or something. Expecting to get him to fold an eight by the river. So at this point, I don't want him to fold, so I'll just keep calling and let him keep betting.
Justin said, I found myself a little lost in this spot. I felt this was a small turn bet, especially on such a wet board. Because of the small turn bet, I felt his range was weighted more towards sixes, nines, or tens, and he was a little scared. If it is the case that he has one of those hands, I think raising is bad, as we have the best hand, and it doesn't give him the opportunity to bluff the river. Also, our equity is much improved against any two pair hands and remains unchanged against sets. I think this is more or less what we were saying. Justin, I don't think it's fair to say that you were lost. I think you analyzed this pretty nicely. The hands that you're ahead of, you're way ahead of, and you don't really have to worry about raising against them. And the hands that, I mean, you have equity, plenty of equity to call, but you don't really benefit by raising into two pairs or sets.
Yeah. Can I amplify this for a second? You know, one thing we say on here a lot is that, not all who wander are lost. You know, not everyone who doesn't know exactly what his opponent has is lost in a hand. Sometimes the right thing to do is keep the other person's range wide. You can pay a lot for information. You can take fancy lines. You can put way too much of your stack at risk just for the sake of information. That's a bad thing. And I think a lot of the desire to know where you're at in a hand is at least sometimes like a holdover from an era where people gave away much more information than they do now. And I would rather play my hand correctly than know exactly what my opponent has. So, I just think, embrace being lost in a hand if that means that you're making the right choice. So kudos to our correspondent for doing the opposite of what, you know, I and some of our correspondents do too often, which is try too hard to figure out, you know, to gain information at the expense of playing correctly.
What's that? That's essentially like the definition of poker, right?
Yeah,
playing without knowing all the information.
Right. Yeah, it wouldn't be a very interesting game if we always knew exactly what our opponents had. And yeah, the meat of poker really is learning how to deal with situations where you don't know what they're doing. And I think it doesn't have to mean being lost. I mean, you can be sure of what the right play is without being sure of your opponent's hand.
What's that?
The river is the deuce of diamonds. So our final board is eight of clubs, seven of clubs, five of, we'll say, spades, king of hearts, deuce of diamonds, and our hero still has ace king of clubs. And someone is making a lot of noise on their microphone right now.
Not me.
It may be me. Okay. I'm using the microphone that's I'm using a microphone that's connected to my ear pods, and so I turn to like let okay. I'm parked in a rental car outside the hotel I used to live in.
We just keep zooming out and getting like another layer.
and there's a wasp in the back seat, so I tried to like move to let the window down so the wasp can get out. And I think my microphone rubbed up against my shirt. So I'll be still and take the risk of getting stung by a bee for the sake of the Thinking Poker Podcast.
We appreciate it. And let me say also, props to you for trying to let the wasp out rather than just killing it. I appreciate that.
Right.
So our board is 8-7-5 king deuce, the two clubs on the flop. Other than that, it's rainbow. Our hero has ace king of clubs. The big blind bets into our hero for the third time, bets 75 into 145. I feel like we can probably rule out raising. So let me know if you disagree with that, but mostly what are your thoughts on calling versus folding?
Yeah.
Maybe you shouldn't be so quick to rule out raising, actually.
Right. I'm thinking, like, these are spots where sometimes I feel like I would always call here, but maybe better players would get more value in this spot by being able to raise fold where I'm not. So I'm trying to, like you said, pause and think twice before I just snap call in these spots. And since
I would rule out raise folding. I'll say that. I mean,
okay.
So we're looking at, I think the effective stack, we started with 300. So the villain has less than 200 remaining in his stack, and he just bet you know, 75 into 145. So, I mean, I think raising is going to be a shove.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, in that case, I like a call.
any consideration of folding?
Yeah, can I make the case for folding? Yeah. Which is not to say that I would fold or believe the folding's correct. The case for folding is that villain's probably value betting a lot, and value bets beat ace king. Like, how many hands is he donking on the flop, betting the turn, and betting the river with for value that are worse than one pair? There really aren't many. It's almost literally impossible to find one. Yeah. So that means that we have to beat bluffs, or I have to be wrong about that. Like, a villain could be sort of making a weird blocking bet, or just a, I don't know, bet with jacks or queens. I guess that's the hand that we're trying to beat. But I think a lot of people will check somewhere with that hand. And so, is he bluffing? Is he over bluffing? I mean, if we can beat any value bets, then you should usually, from a theory perspective, call. But first, I'm not sure that we beat a lot of value bets. And second, I'm not sure there are many bluffs at all. I'm not sure many 1-2 players are appropriately bluff heavy in this spot, especially since, and again, here's something we talk about on the show a lot. The pot was three-handed on the flop. That really changes flop ranges. Changes his, it changes yours. And so the three-barrel bluff is significantly less likely now, even though there hasn't been somebody in the pot for, yeah, whatever, 1 minute of playing time or 20 minutes of discussion time. So that's my case for folding, is that we don't beat value bets and he doesn't have enough bluffs.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good case, actually. I would feel a lot better about our hand if the villain had made something that was more clearly a blocking bet. You know, if he had bet $30 or $50 into 145, I wouldn't even consider folding, because then I would start to think, okay, we can beat, maybe he just has like 8-9 and doesn't want to face a river bet or something. This is not a bet size I would expect from 8-9 or pocket nines. I mean, I think for the villain to bet $75, even though it's only half of the pot, you know, as we've said, and a lot of people know, you know, people are often not that conscious of pot size, and this is a pretty, it's just a big bet in absolute terms, and most people don't do a lot of bluffing, especially not three barrels, especially not in a multiple people. Most people don't do a lot of thin value betting. So I don't feel great about this when the villain is betting, and this is why I said I would rule out raising. If he only bet $30 or $50, I might actually consider jamming. But this feels a lot more to me like, you know, a crying call on the river because we're getting 3-1 and it's not that easy to beat ace king on this board. Versus just saying, well, people don't bluff and they don't make thin value bets, and I'm going to sort of heroically fold. But I think you make the right case, and that's kind of where my thinking would be as well. And I would say it's, even against good players, probably close between the two. And yeah, the more that we think this is just sort of a recreational, not that great player, the more folding is probably the right play.
There's a hashtag for this, by the way.
Yes. this is a classic instance of they always have it. That said, I mean, the more I talk about it, the more I think folding is the right play. I still think I probably call in game because I have top pair, top kicker, and I'm getting 3-1.
Yeah, I think Nate had a great analysis of this river spot. Like, I wasn't even thinking about, okay, we'll probably be here. Like, my whole thought process here is like, we're definitely ahead, so maybe we could, but we're definitely ahead, but would he call a raise? But like, the way Nate broke it down made me realize that, yeah, there, he could have had a weaker eight going into the river and then hit two pair on the or turn. I guess turn is possible. But I feel like we were probably ahead through the majority of this hand. And anybody that just has a weak eight, like in my experience, a lot of times they would rather check call this river than bet it. So I think he maybe weighted more towards two pair better when he bets this river.
Yeah, and you know, I feel like when I was sort of at my peak relative to other poker players, like I'm the best poker player I ever was now, but relative to like all other poker players, I was probably at my best in like 2009. And I made the most, I feel like a lot of the money that I made came from folding in situations like this. And you used to be able to do it more often against better players where you're just like, they just always have it in these situations. And you know, I don't think you want to be making folds like this against better players anymore. I think people have gotten a lot better about like balancing and bluffing and stuff like that. And I don't tend to make these way down. I mean, this isn't even that exploitable of a fold really, but I don't tend to do as much like hero folding against better players anymore. But I think I've let that creep into my play against less elite players. And this seems like one of those spots where you really can. I mean, $75, again, it's like, okay, it's only half the pot. But I mean, just in terms of like your win rate in a 1-3 game, if you can, like, so against some people, I think the difference between calling and folding really is a difference of close to $75 in EV. Like, some people really do just always have it here, and it is always better than ace-king. And so, you know, correctly making an exploitive fold against those players is worth several hours of play at a 1-3 game, right? If you can earn $75 by correctly folding here. And that's a pretty big deal. I guess I'm really coaching myself more than anyone else right now. But, yeah, I mean, I think being able to make good exploitive folds like this in the right situations is a really good skill. And just the flip side is, you know, when you fold and you do actually have the best hand, it's quite an expensive mistake. So you have to be pretty sure of that read. But the more I think about it, the more I think this is one of those spots that we're just always going to see a hand. And, you know, or that we have a pure bluff catcher. And I mean, that's the key thing. It doesn't really matter that we have ace king. I mean, people who want to call here because they have ace king, but would fold like, I don't know, pocket nines or something. I mean, I don't think villain has tens. He's either bluffing or he's got two pair. And so, you know, the fact that you have ace king is really not that relevant.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think it's a little bit relevant, but not that relevant. You know, like, imagine he has jacks or queens. I think that's the real, like, we did raise from early position. This is an OMC, whatever that means.
The OMC was the button he folded.
Motherfucker.
This is the kid who, like, didn't have a player's card and didn't know what a player's card was. And
even that description kind of surprised me, because when he was saying that, that gave me like one view of this guy, but then the guy waited until it was his turn in the big blind. They gave me a different view of him, so I'm a little confused on, like, you know, is this really a recreational player or not, or like some savvy pro that's pretending to be a recreational player?
Or he could just like mostly play online. It's New Jersey, so maybe he plays on the New Jersey sites and just doesn't go to casinos that much.
Do we know whether or not he had a barbed wire tattoo around his bicep? That's pretty relevant here. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. I think it's probably a fold. It's probably a fold.
Are we ready for results?
I think so.
Yeah, he had pocket eight, so he did flop a set.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I've known that all along. I didn't share the results with Carlos or Nate until now, but I have known all along, for those of you who want to take that into consideration. But, I mean, I really do see a case for folding the river that's not just based on my knowledge that this ends up being a set.
Ooh. Yeah. I try not to, you know, try to guess at the results beyond what normal poker reasoning would dictate. But also, we didn't know whether this was somebody writing in because he lost the pot, or somebody writing in because he was worried he played passively and could have gotten more value somewhere. So even that was
or not someone writing in to brag because he jammed.
Oh,
we every once in a while we get those where people are like, I wasn't sure about this hand, and then it, you know, they like win a 500 big blind pot with no pair or something, you know.
Yeah, I love those by the way, because yeah, like those hands are crazy. Please send us your brag hands. That's fine. Yeah, well, you know, maybe it just worked out this time that like I six bet with a top pair third kicker and got called by worse. Yeah, nice hand.
You win. I will say, good if job. You send us your brag hands, those are the ones I'm most tempted to rip apart. If I get the sense that you're proud of the hand, I'm like, there's definitely a part of me that's like, all right, here's everything you did wrong.
Yeah, Yeah, it's like giving an out of the box answer on a test in high school or something. Like you better know that you're right and you can back it up, or else it'll be marked harshly is what I'm saying. Yeah. Sorry, Sean.
Anything else you guys want to talk about?
I want to give a shout out if I can.
Please.
I want to say I mentioned this guy when Nate and I did the podcast together. I think Andrew named it Carlos and Nate talking about God knows what. But I talked about being in Dallas with my buddy Mario Silvestri, who was one of the Shipper Hollow Ballers. He just got third in a WPT in Maryland for I think 160K, a televised event. So, you know, congratulations to Mario. Oh, I'm messing it up. It's Mario, not Mario. He always corrects me on that. He's a proud Italian American. But you know, shout out to Mario for his third place finish in the WPT.
Yeah, I was hoping to go deep enough in that event myself that I would get a chance to meet Mario, but it didn't happen. Although I did, I played with sixth place finisher Kate Hall in a cash game at Maryland Live last night. So,
how'd that go?
Fine. Actually, there was I did play a pot with her that involved her donking multiple streets. Although I folded the turn, so it's not as interesting as the hand that our correspondent shared. But I thought of it because I was sort of unsure of how to proceed.
Did she know it was you when she was doing it?
Yeah, she knows who I am.
Okay.
Yeah. We were like,
so is Nate the only one who hasn't had the pleasure of playing with Kate here?
I have never played with Kate Hall.
I will say that it wasn't that fun for me. I don't like playing against good players, so Kate, go your side.
Well, thanks for joining us, Carlos, and you know, have a good flight. Enjoy your time in Las Vegas, and it's not very likely. There's an outside chance I would come through Vegas pretty soon, but I don't think I'm going to. But if I do, I'll let you know.
Okay, the one good thing about being in Vegas is that there's always somebody coming through at some point. So I think Briar, a friend of the podcast, will be in town at the beginning of November, and I think Killenberg will be in towards the middle of November. So I got, you know, those two guys coming up in November, and then I have a non-poker friend from high school that's going to be coming next week. So
that's right. Yeah, you're going to the Grand Canyon, right?
Yeah, I'm going to the Grand Canyon for the first time, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's good.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Also, take Briar to Red Rock. He likes Red Rock. It's a good place.
Okay, I will. I like Red Rock, too. Thank you guys for introducing me, because that's a place that I never would have ventured to go in Vegas, but it's probably one of the most chill places in Vegas.
Yeah,
nice place. Just a great place overall. But yeah, I guess I'm to the extent that I'm living vicariously through your van living, you know, I would be at the national parks a lot. So it makes me happy to see you hitting up the Grand Canyon, and hopefully you'll enjoy that. You know, Zion is another Zion and Bryce actually both, but Zion in particular, another really awesome place that's a pretty close drive from Vegas. I would really encourage you to check out. And maybe not quite yet, but come November, you'll certainly be past the peak season in Zion. It does get really, I mean, as does the Grand Canyon. Like, at peak season, it's really, really crowded. But if you go in, like, November, it'll be an amazing place to have largely to yourself.
Cool.
So I would be more than happy to curate your trip to to Zion.
I'm in.
All right, we're good talking to you guys, and safe travels,
as always.
Thank you. Have a good day, guys.
Take care. You too.